It's The Wonky Show. Today we're diving into the impact of a sexual misconduct survey. There's a new report that points to the potential impact of the International Students Levy, and we return to course closures after the alarm bells were rung by the Institute for Physics. It's all coming up.
I think we can just make this a part of induction and just at every university just make it really clear. If you experience any of these things on this list, these are not okay. This is where you go and this is what you do, and you do that whoever you are, whatever your orientation, whatever your age, whatever your experience. I'm sure, of course, that many universities do have this, but, you know, whilst we wait for the proper analysis and wait for more to come, we could perhaps get started with that.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to review the week in HE policy, we have three fantastic guests as always. In Oxford, it's Charlotte Corris, Head of Public Policy at the Office for the Independent Adjudicator for Higher Education. What a mouthful that is. Charlotte, your highlight of the week, please.
So my highlight of the week, Mark, was actually from last week, and it was being invited to attend the University Alliance Awards hosted by the University of Hertfordshire. Lovely to hear about some of the specific achievements and contributions happening across University Alliance's lovely membership.
And in Sheffield, it's Mark Bennett, Vice President for Research and Insight at Keystone Education Group. Mark, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, my highlight of the week is actually for next week. Obviously, it's a very quiet week this week. Next week, we are running our Love PG event in Manchester. So it's the UK's only conference dedicated to postgraduate recruitment. It's not a plug because it's already sold out, but I'm just really excited for it.
And somewhere in the southwest of England on the M4 corridor, it's David Kernahan, Wonky's Deputy Editor. David, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's traditional for me, but the British basketball season is back. The Bristol Flyers team looking absolutely superb. 2 for 2 so far. It's tremendously exciting.
Now, we start the week with a new survey out from the Office of Students about sexual misconduct. DK, walk us through it, please.
So this has been a long time coming, but we finally have the results of the sexual misconduct survey, which the Office of Students has been planning to run for quite a long time. There was a pilot with a few institutions last year. This year, it was run alongside the National Student Survey. It was like an optional bit of questions for students in England, and we got a 12.1% response rate. Now, there's a lot of interesting things to say about the statistics and the methodology, but we do need to always bear in mind that these are students who have come forward to talk about their experience of sexual misconduct or sexual harassment. They all deserve to be listened to, and hopefully the mentions in this survey come alongside something more formal, which is happening at an institutional level. From the sample we have, the overall prevalence of experiences of sexual harassment over the last 12 months was 13.3%, but only 13.2% of those made a formal report about it to their university or college. I mean, that to me is the headline finding. Even though students are experiencing this stuff, they are not reporting it, and we need urgently to look at the barriers that are stopping students from making these reports.
Right, lots to unpack here. Charlotte, I want to come straight to you on this issue about the reporting gap, because obviously, as Dika says, it's one of the really big things that jump out at you from this data. What do you think is driving it? And if you could tell us from your work on these sorts of complaints at the OIA, because we need to understand the real scale of the problem here, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is an area that we are seeing an increase in complaints about, both from the reporting and the reported students, actually. And complaints quite often arise if students feel concerns are dismissed, mishandled, or minimised. And it's important we keep that in mind, especially in light of these prevalence rates. To that end, we're actually launching a consultation on a new chapter of our Good Practice Framework, which will hopefully be out by the end of the year, the consultation. And that is going to give some guidance to providers on designing and operating procedures to respond to reports about harassment of any kind and sexual misconduct. It should cover receiving, investigating, and responding to reports, as well as how to handle disciplinary procedures for dealing with students accused of them. So, and it obviously will link to the new E6 condition, which has come out from the OFS, which is now force, and we expect it will help providers to meet the regulatory requirements in these areas, but it's not a comprehensive operational guide to meeting the condition of E6. But I think this data does reinforce the importance of E6 and confirms that harassment and sexual misconduct incidents are not isolated, but are systemic risks. And I hope that providers don't just see E6 as a compliance exercise, but move to a proactive and prevention cultural change.
Mark, there's obviously a major limitation here, isn't there? Because the survey only covered finally your undergraduates. I just want to ask you, because your expertise and experience with PGTs and particularly thinking about the growing international postgraduate population, how significant is that? Sorry, redo that bit. Sorry. How significant is this gap?
Well, definitely. I mean, it's yet another example, really, isn't it? The paucity of data and coverage and attention that we have for the postgraduate student experience. So, as you say, Mark, it's final year undergraduates, incidents reported in all that they've experienced, the reporting incidents or instances that they've experienced in the last 12 months. So that's going to miss masters, it's going to miss PhD. And I don't know, because obviously by definition, we don't have the data, but I would personally worry that some elements of what's being covered here, and the obvious example, I guess, would be staff students, relationships and so on, could be more prevalent at postgraduate level and potentially more of an issue when they occur. You know, I don't want to kind of parade of horrors that we don't know, but we would need data to see that. I'd actually say as well, at the other end, and apologies if I've kind of misinterpreted the data, but the fact that we're only getting third years means that we're talking about incidents that have occurred in the third year or the second year. And I would also imagine that some first years would be particularly vulnerable as well. You know, I don't know if they would experience more of it, but it feels like someone who's just going to university for the first time and amongst, you know, that kind of peer group, this could be more of an issue. So, you know, it's great to see it. It's great to see that we have this survey and that we can try and draw some of the conclusions from it. Obviously, it's difficult in terms of the shape of the sample and the reporting bias and so on. But yes, definitely more work to be done on postgrad, but also I think also undergrad as well. I suppose the issue there is the fact that it's a bolt on to the NSS, isn't it? So postgraduate NSS, please.
That brings me on to the methodology, DK. We do need to talk about this a bit because we've got a 12.1 response rate on the bolt on to the NSS, as Mark says. And a write up note suggests that vulnerable groups were more likely to respond and more likely to report misconduct. So how do we interpret these prevalence figures?
We do need to interpret these very, very carefully. There's a number of caveats in the OFS publication, which, I mean, they've been clear they're at the early stages of analysing this data and they don't want to draw conclusions overall for the whole sector at that point, which makes it kind of slightly awkward that they've also released data for the whole sample and implied in certain ways that it is sector-wide data.
But just to say, we're not getting institutional breakdowns, are we? They don't want to see league tables.
Yeah, we're not getting institutional breakdowns this time. I think, as well as the risk of league table effications and the question of whether a healthier provider, shall we say, more people are likely to report any problems, and that a provider with a low number of reports might just have a culture of don't ask, don't tell, which is utterly indefensible in this day and age. So the issue always with stuff like this, when you've got a large sample, but it's not necessarily a representative sample, is the idea of respondent bias, that certain groups are more likely to respond and also certain groups are more likely to report sexual misconduct. What seems to be happening to me, and again, I'm just looking at this data and haven't done any proper analysis of it, it looks like students from a more advantaged background, looking at stuff like the disadvantage quintiles, are more likely to report sexual misconduct and sexual harassment. This doesn't suggest to me that these students are more likely to experience these things in their career as students. It suggests to me that they're more likely to feel confident in reporting it. And that is something that would need a lot of unpicking. So this is really interesting data, but we do need to be very careful about drawing responses across the whole sector or saying that the sector has a particular problem with this, this, and this, because there's lots of stuff in the data that needs to be properly unpicked. And I know the stats team at the OFS are very, very talented, and they will be working on this to see, I mean, what they can realistically say they have discovered. And hopefully the publicity around this release would result in a larger response rate in years to come. It's possible eventually this survey even could be made compulsory. And I mean, obviously that would give us a better and clearer picture.
Sean, I want to ask you something else specifically about, based on your experience of complaint handling. So one of the other things that really jumps out of the data is that 58.4% of harassment cases and 44.1% of assault cases involve someone connected to the victim's university, but it happened off campus. So that's quite startling. How does that challenge do you think the kind of traditional approaches to institutional jurisdiction when it comes to complaints? And what do you think the implications are for universities, particularly in E6, which you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, isn't it, now that, you know, universities are not viewed how they were, and institutional accountability is wider than just what is happening on campus. But that is challenging for providers. And I think they need to come up with considered and innovative ways of managing to protect students wherever they are. And the E6 condition is very clear on this. But yes, it is a worrying concern, and it is a challenge for providers to try and resolve that.
One of the things, I mean, I take DK's point, Mark, about, you know, the fact that we can't draw, we have to be wary of the conclusions we draw from this data. We need to let the OFS data team do their job first. It's great to see that the data is there. Let's analyze it properly. But if I was being a bit gung-ho, one thing I think we can look at is that the confidence in seeking support feels pretty low. So it's only around about 2/3 of people, again, if I've interpreted correctly, say they're confident in seeking support. We also know that, you know, was it only 12% of students under 21 do report? It's lower for non-heterosexual orientations as well. All of this, I actually don't think we need to get into the weeds of the data here. I think we can just make this a part of induction, and just at every university, just make it really clear. If you experience any of these things on this list, these are not okay. This is where you go, and this is what you do. And you do that whoever you are, whatever your orientation, whatever your age, whatever your experience. I'm sure, of course, that many universities do have this. But, you know, whilst we wait for the proper analysis and wait for more to come, we could perhaps get started with that.
So the other angle to this is that we need to look at, I mean, what institutions can actually do to make this a less common problem that students have to experience. Well, one of the graphs I was drawn to particularly was on the identity of the people connected to the reported incident of sexual harassment. Now, overwhelmingly, this is other students. This is students harassing other students. And all of the other bigger groups are people who are not necessarily connected with the university itself. I mean, these are friends or acquaintances, these are hookups, these are employers at work, these are partners, these are people with professional placements. The classic model of sexual harassment at university is the idea of the lecturer's lecturer, the kind of history man model of academics basically perving over their students, which if anybody still thinks that that's something that is allowed, it is absolutely not the kind of thing that should be happening at a university. And the prevalence of those kind of thing among people that are actually reporting sexual harassment, quite low, surprisingly low. The overwhelming issue is with other students. And that suggests to me that, again, in the early years of the course, there needs to be some kind of education about consent, about, I mean, what actually constitutes sexual malpractice. I mean, these are young 18-year-olds, largely quite inexperienced in relationships and these kind of matters. I think guidance and support, it would be a very, very good thing as well. Although I do add the caveat that this might be difficult to put together in the current political climate.
I think that's right, DK. And I think what's interesting in some of the complaints we see in that lecturer-student dynamic is that I think students do find that sometimes harder to raise complaints about. They are less sure of their rights, and obviously they're concerned about any comeback from that. So I think it's really important to dig a bit deeper in that. The other thing, I think, when we're talking about induction and things, it's really important that I think student unions are brought into that by their universities. I think they've got many, many ways of helping to highlight and support and educate students in this, and I'd be really interested to hear what institutions are doing alongside their student unions in this area.
I wonder what we should do about this. So current approaches like the supervisory relationship bans and registers, maybe not creating the right culture. How should we be handling the power dynamics in universities, especially in postgraduate contexts?
Yeah, well, exactly. I think, you know, we said at the outset, didn't we, that we don't have data for postgrads, but let's assume that if this is happening, for third year undergraduates, it's happening more for postgraduates. So 1.5%, we've got to be wary of that. You know, you can extrapolate that out and draw some silly headlines and so on, which I know Wonky won't do, other places might. It's still, if my maths is correct, over 700 people. So that's a lot. And that is a concerning headline. So yes, I think, you know, it kind of comes back to the points that, you know, we've all really made, that Charlotte's made, I've made, and that DK has made. You know, it just needs to be really clear what is and isn't acceptable. As you move into postgrad, you know, if you're an undergrad, chances are you may not even know who your tutor is half the time. It's probably someone who you can go to if something goes wrong. And most of the time, thankfully, it doesn't go wrong academically, okay? at postgrad, even at master's level, you are proper. I remember my own master's. I was in a group with about three other people, and it really is. It was great. You're in there with this person who is the expert. There's a real sense of, you know, being someone's mentee or apprentice. There's a huge amount of respect, you know. And then of course you go up to research, and you are having office hours with these people. You are probably also socializing. You know, I had a lot of coffees with my supervisors. I occasionally had a beer with them, and I think that again, you know, it feels like a fairly obvious point to make, but it's about guidance, isn't it? And even though we don't have the postgraduate NSS and we don't necessarily know what's happening, I don't think there's any risk. We can probably assume that it is more of an issue, or is more of a risk, let's say, and we can actually start thinking about it and just give really good guidance. In my experience, I've moved between a lot of universities in my student career, my academic career, and obviously we work with a lot of them at Keystone. I think actually that it does vary. And I don't think I've ever seen, it's not that it's bad anywhere in terms of guidance for, you know, expectations of the supervisory relationship, but it varies a lot. And that's something that perhaps we can think about. And obviously there are organizations like UKCG, for example, that do work on this. So maybe this needs to be part of that.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Keith Parry, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about students as curriculum critics and inclusive curricula. Now, despite global ambitions, many university curricula remain rooted in Eurocentric traditions. They create white spaces or classrooms and learning environments where students from minoritised backgrounds don't see the histories or perspectives represented. The message is clear, the curriculum isn't for them. The gap leaves students carrying invisible labour, constantly translating, critiquing and adapting knowledge that feels distant to them. One way forward is to see students not as passive consumers, but as curriculum critics, genuine partners in shaping what and how we teach. When trained and supported, students can highlight blind spots, diversify reading lists, and challenge assumptions about what knowledge counts. It's about sharing power, not just gathering feedback. And by embedding student partnerships, universities can create curricula that all learners will feel they belonged in.
Now, there's been a new report about the impact of the International Student Levy and what it means to universities. Charlotte, walk us through it, please.
Yes, if you cast your mind back to May this year, we found out that amongst other proposals, there was an announcement that the government wanted to explore the potential introduction of an International Student Fee Levy, which was to be reinvested into the higher education and skills system. The details regarding timelines and practicalities, such as collection mechanisms and enforcement procedures, are not included in the white paper. And although there wasn't a fixed fee or percentage confirmed, the annex of the white paper used a 6% model for the levy's impact. The Home Office thought on its predictions that it could equate to a drop of 14,000 students a year in the short term and 7,000 students a year in the longer term. As a sector fight hard to prevent this coming in, Public First on commission for various universities has had another look at the modelling, thinking about non-EU students and using different assumptions. Its calculations find the effect would be greater than the Home Office predicted and more like 16,000 students fewer in the first year, which it suggests would represent a £240 million loss of income for the sector. The report then considers how this could affect home student places or research, assuming the cost is borne through reductions in spending elsewhere. We're promised further news on this proposal in the budget at the end of November.
All right, so Mark, the methodology aside, there clearly is a kind of, there is going to be a big impact, isn't there, in the International Student Levy. And whether it's this report or the government's own modelling, it's going to be significant. What do you think the case should be? Is it that, you know, and what's the kind of purpose of this? Is it that we're saying, don't do this because the sector's going to lose money, or don't do this because of soft power, research, all the other national security, all the things that the report mentions? What do you think is going to land best with policymakers? Because it's obviously part of a lobbying effort, isn't it?
Well, look, I don't know what will land best with the policymakers, but I think, yes, both of those things. Don't do this because it may hurt the sector financially. Don't do this because it may hurt the sector reputationally. But do you know what else? Don't do this because you don't know what impact it's going to have. For me, what's most interesting, I don't think we really need to get into the different methodologies and so on. The point here is we have two different ways of modelling this. They are different, and that tells us we basically don't know. It's really hard to model this stuff. It's not so much what the forecast finds, so as, you know, they're being conducted by bright people with good data in good faith, should we say. They find different things, you know. And I think, without soapboxing too much, this would be yet another example by a different government this time, but yet another example of a policy on international education where the effect on the size and shape of provision, the student body and so on, is basically an unknown at this point. You know, I don't know if the government is making assumptions about which groups of international students as well. Maybe they are. Let's say, for the sake of argument, someone is thinking, right, we want less less of these students, because they do talk, don't they, about lower tariff universities and rankings and so on. And I personally think that's a bit silly. But let's imagine they're doing that. They're saying, aha, if we put the prices up by this amount, it will mean we get less recruitment from X, Y, and Z. I would seriously caution the governments, based on the kind of work we do at Keystone and what we see in data for prospective students, I would really caution them against making any assumptions about that. Yes, some groups of students are more price sensitive than others, but all students are becoming more price sensitive now, which isn't a surprise. You know, there's a part of Keystone, I'll be very brief on this, but there's a part of Keystone called UniQuest, okay? It's a service. They help support enrollments for UK unis. They do this at a massive scale. They are the people to talk to if you want to understand what prospective students applying for a UK degree are saying, okay? And their data shows that applicants from all regions, that includes China and East Asia, all regions, are citing finance as a blocker much more. I think it's increased by over a third since 2023. So we really don't know what impact this is going to have in terms of recruitment and what impact that will then have financially and how it will impact different institutions.
DK, if universities end up having to absorb the cost of a levy or pass it to students, where, you know, what part of institutions do you think are going to suffer most?
I'll start by answering what part of the sector, if I may. There is differing levels of price sensitivity to applications to different parts of the sector. If you are a bright and staggeringly well-off Chinese student and you want to go to Oxford or Cambridge, you're going to go to Oxford or Cambridge. There's nothing going to stop you. There's not going to be a price differential. And that's kind of more likely for people that are aiming for high prestige course or a high prestige institution. They want to go there. A few hundred pounds each way is not going to make a big difference. It is going to have a larger impact at the end of the sector that is serving underserved international students, especially at the master's level. I'll be interested to hear some more from Mark on this. They are going to struggle to recruit because that end of the market, it is price sensitive. These are people who are not necessarily certain they can afford the tuition fees, they can afford the NHS levy, they can afford the cost of the visa, they can afford the amount of money that they need to bring in to show that they can support themselves. All of this stuff is becoming more expensive, and it is that end of the market that we've seen in the last couple of cycles that have been struggling to recruit. Now, the government might have the opinion, I don't know this for certain, that this would be a good thing, that we need to focus on what people always like to call the brightest and best, which means largely the most middle class and the richest students, and we should support that end of immigration, and we should cut out the other stuff where the perception is these are students that are more likely to claim asylum, these are students that are perhaps more likely to be applicants that are not necessarily coming to the UK because they want to study a particular course at a particular institution. So the other thing to bear in mind is what's going to happen to the money collected via the levy. As usual, the sector has looked on an extra charge to itself and has lost its mind. That we've not seen a lot of thought about what the government would actually do with the income for this levy. It says it would invest it in the higher education and skills sector. And I mean, that potentially is perhaps better for the sector than everybody having to go out and recruit international students if they're not set out to do something. If it is a redistributive policy, if there's certain institutions that can charge international postgraduates 100K, why shouldn't the rest of the sector get a little bit of the benefit of that astonishing level of income? There's also the idea of it going to the wider skills sector. This potentially is a good thing in that it would result in more home students that are likely to have the qualifications and the learning experience to apply to universities near them. It's potentially widening the pool. So there's lots and lots to this. The focus on the price and the cost and the impact on recruitment, that is an important bit, but there are lots of other factors to think about.
It sounds a bit like Premier League solidarity payments, doesn't it? But for universities. So, you know, Oxford and Cambridge can recruit loads and loads of international students, but it's okay because we'll pay some money to Anglia Ruskin and Oxford Brookes. I've tried not to be too silly about it, but yeah. It's an interesting idea, isn't it? I don't think the government's been really, well, it hasn't been clear at all, hasn't said what it's going to do with it, has it? It's made some vague noises. So yeah, if it works, right? If it works.
Yeah, it's a floated idea that's not even at the consultation stage yet. So, you know, we need to treat it in that respect as well.
just from a student's point of view, I think international students are already paying a premium to come and study here. And I think from their point of view, if they are paying even higher rates and not getting that put back into their sort of general student experience, that could be reputationally damaging for the UK in its competitive international market. I also just think anything that introduces further financial instability into the system is not a great thing at the moment.
Now, Mark, the Institute of Physics is sounding the alarm about something. What's the alarm ringing about?
I mean, I don't know about you, Mark, but I get wary when physicists sound alarms. But yeah, this was an initially strange read for me, actually, as someone with an academic background in the humanities. I'm kind of used to hearing about, you know, departmental cuts and mergers close to home, but the Institute of Physics is warning of possible course and department closures in, surprisingly enough, physics. So it's a new report. It's based on a survey of 31 heads of department, and it finds that 3 of those are closing. So that's almost 10% of the sample. I can do maths. And 8, so that's more than a quarter, seeing closure as a possibility within 2 years. Lots of other findings as well. So it finds that 4 out of 5 of these departments are facing staff cuts. There's evidence of reductions in facilities, which of course is absolutely critical, isn't it? You know, infrastructure for a subject like physical sciences, and course closures as well, probably linked to that. Finally, it warns that physics is particularly vulnerable. Obviously, it has high research and teaching costs, and department closures, quoting the report, would be sudden, uncoordinated, and chaotic. And there's an observation that Research Council funding for physics has begun to decline, and student numbers have been decreasing since the pandemic. So there's kind of a supply side and demand side issue there, it seems.
Sudden and chaotic closures are not my favourite type, I need to say. This has made me really, really sad, actually. Physics is a gateway to underrepresented groups in STEM, and providers really need to mitigate risks against widening participation on this. We need to make sure there's a strategic approach if this is going to happen to ensure we're meeting not only the future needs of the country, but also not leaving disadvantaged students without a route into physics. We can't end up with a situation where lots of providers are closing the same courses simultaneously. That will be a disaster for students. And I'm sure physics isn't the only area where this is being talked about. There are lots of high research and teaching cost subjects where they will be facing closure. I think what we found in our report with sums on putting students first, mitigating the impact of higher education closure. And although that focused largely on provider closure, there is quite a lot of read across to subject and course closure. And we really found that there needs to be a shift in culture and behaviour within providers to strengthen their approach on this to risk management and being prepared for potential closure. We found that student protection plans are not often detailed enough or concrete enough to actually help in these situations. And it's really important that there is a coordinated student-centre approach. Providers need to be engaging with their students' unions, their students need clear and timely communication, and where we often see complaints arise in course closure is from poor communication. They're told very late in the day what's going on, and the communication is often not transparent and not compassionate in its approach. We quite often see before closure, in fact, that the reduction in staffing and facilities really compromises quality and supervision, and that can lead to complaints in itself. And I think providers here need to be mindful of consumer legislation when they're thinking about closing these courses. If there is a failure to offer viable alternatives which work for individual students and their circumstances, that's going to trigger complaints, and that will be made a million times worse if there are lots and lots of the same courses closing at one time.
DK, this also points to kind of wider issues, doesn't it, about specialisation in the sector. You know, there's got to be clarity from government about subjects that are a priority, and there's got to be something that stops, you know, important specialisms just from disappearing because of generic financial pressures, right?
Yeah, I mean, this speaks to the whole issue that we don't really have any means of planning the size and shape of our higher education system, that the kind of approach we have is just to let the cumulative decisions of 18-year-olds define what gets taught and where it gets taught. We seem to be in a situation where large parts of the sector are teetering around the brink of financial crisis. Obviously, a lot of the sector is looking for an injection of money, but equally important is an injection of strategy. If we can't support the sector at its current size, shape, and scope, and the shape of the sector needs to be different, this needs to be planned. We cannot just let the market define the skills that we need for the future, the research capacity that we need, and the kind of opportunities that are on offer to young people who are looking to get a qualification to set them off in a career that's actually going to benefit. I mean, pretty much every professional body has produced a report like this in recent months, and they all say broadly the same thing. The closures are going to be uncoordinated, they're going to be sudden, it's going to be difficult to look after the interests of students, and it's going to be difficult to look after the interests of employers and a local place. And it just, again, it just screams out to me, we don't have a strategy for the size and shape of the sector. And if we're not going to actually fund it properly, we need to be explicit about the decisions that we're making, which means that some kind of mitigations can be put into place.
Okay, jump in quickly as well. I think there's a link between, you know, what DK is saying about specialization and shape of the sector and the point Charlotte made about physics as a gateway and access. Let's say, you know, that we think fewer universities should do physics. That's a bit of a hot take, probably not what we're going to say, but okay. It's probably not going to be 25% fewer as per the concerns here. But regardless, you know, there's a question about how that shapes demand and access. Let's say we have fewer places, maybe they're centralized, well, they're hubs, they're in particular regions, okay, you know, and fewer of those offer these higher cost subjects like physics. And maybe there's a really positive argument for that. And actually now, you know, research, funding for research is more efficient, et cetera. Because of course, you know, universities already form, you know, collaborative networks and so on for this. So you could make a case for that, right? But what that's going to mean is that if you are a prospective undergraduate or postgrad, but you know, you're a prospective student who wants to study physics, you, to do that, are far more likely to need to relocate. You will need to travel, you will need to live away from home. That will be more expensive. So you need to be the kind of student in our fundamentally broken student finance system that can afford that. And if you can't, you will have to study something else closer to where you are, unless of course you're lucky enough to live next to one of these hubs. So yeah, just to agree, really, it comes back to that sense of planning and these unforeseen impacts that we might have.
There is an impact on student information as well. I mean, obviously, I am the person in our local community or friendship circles or whatever that understands higher education. I get more and more parents are asking me, okay, my lad's off to do this particular subject in this particular institution. Is that all right? Is it going to close? And it's utterly ridiculous that it falls down to me and my interpretation of the stuff in the annual accounts. And he's the data that's like, yeah, okay, that one looks to be all right. There's nothing that's immediately concerning me. Or yeah, there has been reports of concerns regarding that course. That could be a problem. You need to be careful. It's a horrible message to send to somebody, especially if we're looking at a kid who's first in family going to university, really excited, and be able to say, yeah, that particular subject area in that particular institution, there's been reports of financial problems, there's been reports of possible closures. We can't communicate this stuff to applicants. And obviously there is an entrenched interest in the sector in not communicating this to applicants, because obviously if you say this course is probably going to close, then no one's going to apply to it and it is going to close. But for people looking at Go University at the moment who are picking through news reports, sensationalized stuff in the Mail and the Telegraph or whatever else, local rumors in Facebook groups, and trying to use that as a calculus for where to apply, what subject to do, what to do with the rest of their lives, it is genuinely horrifying.
I think you're right, DK, and I think that the issue really goes to the heart of what higher education is for and what it does for people. If you're constantly thinking, oh, if I go there, my course might close, or if I can't afford to go to this, I want to do physics, but I can't afford to go to one of the very small number of places that are now offering it, you know, that's really tragic and really falls against everything that higher education should be.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe, just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you heard today, do come to the Festival of Higher Education in November, where we'll be picking up many of these themes in the big debate. Details on wonky.com. So thanks very much to Charlotte, Mark and Michael who make the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jen will be here. Until then, stay wonky.